Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard. Today, our very special guest is Alan Godfrey. Alan Godfrey is a retired police constable who wrote the book, Who or What Were They? It's a story about Alan Godfrey's experience being taken on board a craft, having an encounter with ETs, and then the aftermath. And his aftermath is something that I can relate to because, you know, I've been on the receiving end of, let's say, unfair or unwanted interference, unwanted attention in the past. So his story really touches me at a deep personal level. Alan is, sharing of himself and his time today, and we're very grateful for that. So without any further ado, Alan Godfrey, welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard Show.
Good morning here from the United Kingdom. As you quite rightly say, James, back in the 1980s, as a serving police officer in the West Yorkshire Police, two very strange events happened within a space of 6 months. One being the discovery of a dead body, and the other one, of course, was a close encounter. Would you like me to go through the dead body and...
Yeah, please. Tell us a bit about your background as a law enforcement officer and then, you know, the dead body and how it tied in to...
It all ties in together, you see.
Yeah.
Well, I was a serving police officer from 1974 to 1984 with the West Yorkshire Police. I was seriously injured on duty in 1984, seriously assaulted, which meant I had to go into hospital and have some operations. And I was deemed, after having the operations, I was deemed physically unfit to carry on as a police officer. So sadly, in 1984, I had to leave the job I loved. But nevertheless, I had an enjoyable 10 years, or most of it. In June of 1980, whilst out on foot patrol in the town centre of Todmorden, which is where I was living at the time and serving, I got a radio message regarding a body had been found in a coal yard, which was adjoining to the Todmorden railway station. And would I meet Alpha Bravo 3, which was a patrol car driven by my late friend, PC Malcolm Agley. I met him, and we proceeded to go up to the coal yard. On arrival there, there was an ambulance in attendance and the owner of the coal yard. As we got out of the car, now the coal yard was situated, I have to tell you, in a very isolated spot. It's not a place where most people in Todmorden would have ever have been. It was next to the railway lines, but it was the end of a long, long path. Track before he actually entered the coal yard. In the coal yard itself was shaped in like a horseshoe shape, and there were segments of sleepers put in where different grades of coal had been deposited. In the centre was a large hopper for filling the loose coal into bags. Next to the hopper was one of these corrals with all this coaling, supported by sleepers on one wall. On top of that pile of coal was a dead body. The only safe way to go up to have a look at it was to climb the sleepers, and it was raining, so it was, it's quite wet and slippery. Malcolm, being the more senior constable than myself, he went up first, and he stood there looking over the edge. And he stood there for quite a while, and I kept saying, "Everything all right, Mal?" And he came back down and said, "I think you better go up and have a look yourself, Alan." So I climbed these sleepers, which it was about 14 feet, 15 feet high, something like that. And as you got to the top, as you peered over, the body was right there, inches from your face, and you was looking at this dead body. And I've seen many dead bodies, but this dead body sent shivers down his spine. His eyes were wide open. It was a male. His eyes were wide open, and there was you kind of looked into his eyes, and there was something saying to you, these eyes saw something that really scared him. Something scared him. Anyway, after several minutes, I could notice that at the crown of the skull, through the short cropped hair, there were individual what appeared to be burn marks, probably the size of a penny, an old penny, round the back of the crown of the head. And as I'm looking at it, I thought, well, you know, that's unusual. What's caused them? And as I just looked, I could see just down the side of the neck marks. So I turned the head over to the left, and I could then see the nape of the neck. There was an open wound, and it had this ointment or some substance had been smeared across it. Quick glance at the full body, and it occurred to me that he was wearing a jacket, but no shirt. And he was wearing what we call in England a string vest. I don't know what you call them over there, but like a vest that's all holes in it, you know, a string vest. The trousers, it might appear to have been fastened wrongly. I don't know. There was just something about it. They're very slack round there. I noticed that the jacket he was wearing was fastened in the wrong button, in the wrong buttonhole. There's just something very weird. And I came back down and I said to Malcolm, oh, what do you think? He said, I think the guy's been bloody dumped. I said, yeah, I'm the same opinion. Instantly we decided it wasn't a natural death, a natural cause of death. There was something that wasn't right. So we then sent for the CID, Criminal Investigation Department, to come and have a look, and also the scenes of crime officers to come and photograph the scene and, you know, make sure everything was honky-dory. And that's what we did. As we were waiting for them to come, we screened off the area, tried to keep the scene safe. And eventually, CID turned up, doctors turned up, bosses turned up, everybody turned up. And the body was photographed. The fourth surgeon, who was the doctor, turned up and pronounced life extinct. You know, you can't call a dead body a dead body until the doctor's been and says it's dead, even though the head might be missing, you know what I mean? So we had a time of life extinct. The body was eventually moved to Hebden Bridge Mortuary, which is approximately 5 miles from Todmorden. It was a local mortuary. It wasn't in a hospital or anything. It was on its own standing building. A post-mortem was carried out by Dr. Alan Edwards, Doc Edwards, Alan Edwards, who was the senior pathologist for Halifax Division. I wasn't present, but the coroner's officer from Halifax, the sergeant, was. The circumstances surrounding the death and where it was found and all that sort of stuff was read to the pathologist. He did his post-mortem, and he also took a swab of the substance, of the ointment that was across the back of the neck, which was later sent to our home office scientific laboratories at Wetherby for analysis to see what the ointment was. But the doctor, pathologist, came back and said he'd died from a heart attack. Natural causes. There was no other, you know, he couldn't find any other injuries on him other than the burn marks and obviously the one at the back of the neck. But his body, he'd given up life, if you like, through a heart attack. At which stage, of course, we didn't know who the guy was at this stage. CID kind of said, well, it's a natural cause of death, and kind of left it to Malcolm, really, and myself to make some inquiries with the assistance of a junior detective, a detective constable. And in the meanwhile, there was a, as I say, the substance had been sent to Wetherby Home Office Forensic Laboratories at Wetherby. Later on, you know, weeks later, it came back from those, a report came back from the laboratories saying that they couldn't identify what the substance was. They had no idea what it was. Which kind of, you know, it's kind of baffling if you think your forensic laboratories don't couldn't identify it. But nevertheless, inquiries were made, missing persons. And it's like when you drop a pebble in a pond and it starts spreading out. Eventually, we got as far as Wakefield, missing persons, and one appeared to match the deceased. And it turned out it was him eventually. And he'd been missing 6 days. He was called Zygmunt Adamski. He was a 56-year-old coal miner in that area. He was ready for, he was waiting for early retirement. As it transpires, the day he disappeared, he'd been to a big shopping centre with a relative, and he'd returned back to his home where his wife Hetty was. He was given, I believe it was his goddaughter away at a wedding the following day. They had lunch, and Etty, his wife, asked Zygmunt, or Ziggy, as his friends called him, if he'd go to the local shop and buy some groceries so she could make for dinner later. And it was a nice sunny day in June, and he set off, spoke to a neighbour, walked to the shops, bought the groceries, exchanged pleasantries with the shop owner who knew him, and he seemed in good spirits. He left the shop and was never seen again until he turned up 20 miles away in Tomenden, in a town he'd never been there before, in an area that most people in Tomenden have never been, on top of this pile of coal, dead. Which, of course, in any circumstances, it must raise suspicions, you know. And obviously, years and years and years later, after I'd left the job, I became aware of more about UFOs and stuff. And Travis Walton, the American, came to my notice, and the similarities are very similar. He were missing, I believe, for 6 days or something, and been abducted and what have you. Whether that's the case in Adamski's case, I don't really know. There's two questions that bother me. I and Malcolm believe that the body, he didn't die where he was found. It didn't make sense. Why would a man that had been missing 6 days turn up in an isolated area in this coal yard, climb a stack of coal in the rain, and simply die lying on the top of it? It just makes sense. Then secondly, if he didn't die where he was found, and there's no suspicion that he was murdered or anything, you know, he died of an heart attack, why would somebody dispose of the body, whether it be for a criminal act or just didn't want to get involved? Why would they? Well, how did they get him to the top of that pile of coal? So the two scenarios I've always been unable to answer. None of them make sense. But at the time, apparently, which I was totally unaware of, there was a lot of activity regarding UFOs, and the area where Tomenden is well known as UFO Valley, apparently, to those that are involved in UFOs, which I wasn't, of course, I had no idea. And that was that. I mean, inquiries were made, and, you know, trying to discover where he'd been, but nothing. And when he left that shop, there was no record No information came forward from as he left the shop to, until he turned up, as I say, on top of this pile of coal. And at the inquest, an inspector, supervisory officer, did the inquest. I wasn't called, Malcolm wasn't called, no other witnesses were called, other than the inspector, who told the James Turnbull, who was the Majesty's coroner, that he was satisfied that Mr. Adamski died at the scene, which totally flew in the face of everybody else's opinions. And what made it worse is that inspector, it never even visited the scene, you know. So questions were asked, you know, me and Malcolm tried to, and then the case is classified. The report, although it was read out in open court and things like that, nobody can get the full file, even today. And believe you me, there's lots of people tried, including media and, you know, reporters, television people. They're all interested in it, but zoot. And that's that, and it's still classified today.
There have been cases, as I'm sure you're aware, in the UFO lore of these mysterious deaths associated with UFOs and presumably the occupants within them. I had Lon Strickler on the show not too long ago, and he talked about this mysterious death of a man in Pennsylvania, I think an island in the middle of a river somewhere on a hilltop, and the site where they found the body, apparently there was a UFO hovering right above that body. So, you know, you have the time, location. And so how long down the track did it dawn on you that perhaps this activity that was going on there may have had a relevance to the body? And then also the whatever black ops skullduggery that went along with it.
Well, UFOs had never even come into my mind. You know, I was a police constable doing my normal duties. I was looking at it more from a crime aspect, you know, trying to... So, the UFO theory, shall I call it, came from newspaper, but originally came from, I believe, you know, local UFO ufologists, call them what you like, and reports that people around the area had seen UFOs and all that sort and reported it. That's where the theory came from. Mm. At the time, I didn't know anything about that theory anyway. It hadn't even entered my head. Until, of course, we move on 6 months or thereabouts to November 1980, the 28th of November. I was on nights. Night patrol, which starts at 10 p.m. till 6 a.m. So, roughly, the night had gone pretty normally until the early hours of the morning. There were several of us on duty, of course, and a call came into the local Nick where we were stationed regarding some cows that was wandering around a local council housing estate. Which is on the right-hand side of the valley, of Burnley Valley. And me and one of my colleagues went up in the police car and went round the estate, couldn't see anything, no trace of these cows, put it down to a prank call, you know, probably somebody coming home for a pub or something, you know, and whatever. And then another call came in, and then another. And then several calls came in, and we just thought it was pranksters. And then one came in, apparently from it was an old lady that lived in one of the bungalows. So I went up, because it was an old lady, I thought, well, she's not likely to cause a prank. And she, as I went to see her, she said she'd heard this noise outside the building. And as she looked out of a bedroom window, she saw these cows. As she went to report the matter with the police, there was a big, she says there was like a flash of light. And when she next looked out, they'd gone. So again, we searched the area up and down each avenue. No, no trace at all. Anyway, I'll move on to some hours later. We got to about 5 a.m. In other words, about an hour before my shift was due to end. One of my colleagues who was doing the switchboard was going off duty at 5 a.m. He'd asked for an hour off anyway. And Paul Richardson. So I left the police station with him. He lived in the police accommodation flats across from the police station. I'll see you later, see you tomorrow, blah, blah, blah. I jumped in the patrol car, went down into Tomlin Town Centre, which is only less than half a mile away from the police station. When I got down there, I saw the staff bus going up Burnley Road. Put my hand up, I knew the driver. Bobby Coates, or Robert Coates, Bobby we call him. Spoke to a colleague that was doing foot patrol, asked him if he wanted to come. I said, I want to go and look, see these cows. Do you fancy coming? He says, no. He says, I'll carry on doing checking shops and things, town centre. I said, oh, all right then. So I turned the car around. And I stood talking to him for five or 10 minutes anyway. I turned the car around, drove back past the police station. I was about to turn up a road called Fernley Road, which leads up to this housing estate. And as I was about to turn up there, I was in the centre of the road. And as I looked at the main road coming towards me, there was no traffic. I just noticed something about 250 yards away. At first I thought it was a bus gone sideways. Then I remembered, well, it was a single-decker bus that had gone up, so it weren't a dual-decker. Oh, the bloody hell's that? So I drove slowly towards it, and as I got closer and closer, I thought, what the bloody hell? And it was something, I got within 20 yards of it. I stopped the police car, and right there, just hanging above the road, was this object. Wasn't touching the road, it was about 5 foot off it. I could see under. And it was about 20 feet wide, about 14 feet high. And it was shaped like a diamond. I mean, hot air balloon came to mind. You know, these things go through your head like that, split second. Your brain's trying to work out what you're actually looking at. And I put all my blue flashing lights on, and, you know, and they were reflecting back off it. And then I noticed the leaves, because it was November, all the dead leaves had dropped off the trees, and it had been raining that night, but it was lifting up and it was swirling round like this. And I just sat there bloody absolutely gobsmacked. I got on my radio. We carry a personal radio, and then there's a car radio on different frequencies. I couldn't get any response off my personal radio. So I picked the car radio up, and again, I got no response. Both were completely dead. It wasn't surprising about the personal radio, because you're in valleys and you do get black spots, you know, where you can't be picked up. But the car radio was a lot stronger. I think that was on VHS. Yeah. The car radio was on VHS, wherever that is. I'm not a technician, but it was on a stronger signal, and that couldn't be picked up. And as I looked at this object, as I say, it was diamond-shaped, and there looked to be black panelling across the top of it, or could have been glass, I don't know, but it was black. And there's like a light on top of that, like a fluorescent type thing. And it was just, and it was spinning. And at first I thought it was spinning anti-clockwise because it was going, seemed to be slow like that, yet the leaves were going that way. It was right, like an optical illusion. You know, when you see wheels on a car, on a film, they look to go going backwards. Well, it had that impression in on my brain as I'm looking at it, but the leaves were going the opposite way. Very weird. So I mean, let's be honest, we're talking 1980, mobile phones hadn't even been invented, you know what I mean? So no cameras with us or anything. So the best I could do to keep a record of it, I picked me a clipboard, which we have all this paperwork on, blank sheets of paper and report things on. I just started to draw it. And then just this white, complete white. You know, when you're in a dark room or at a party and it's dark and people flash the cameras in, there's a flash and it makes your eyes go a little bit funny for a split second. Well, you multiply that by 1,000 times, probably more, just white. It went like, woof, right blinding, and then it had gone. And I, for some strange reason, was another 20 yards further up the road driving the bloody police car. You know, it shook me head with it. So I turned the car around, came back to the scene, and I got out, you know, I got to where it was. I got out the police car. I could see on the road, it had been raining, as I said. There was this dry whirlpool on the tarmac, but all these leaves as well, and very strange. Jumped in the car, got my mate who I'd seen on the town centre. We came back to the scene. He saw it was still there. And we're right to the side of a park, Centreville Park. And in between the park and the road is a very deep river, for want of a better word, the River Goyt. But to get into the park, you go across a very small bridge, which is locked gates. Well, they shut. We went in there, and lo and behold, the cows were there on the rugby pitch, which was about 20 metres away from where this UFO had been. Right as you went in the entrance of the park, you passed some flower beds, and then the rugby pitch was there, and they were all munching away there. I did a report. We got back to the Nick and reported that we found the cows, which had to be, they had to find out who they belonged to. And it turned out that the morning shift, they belonged to a farmer on that side of the valley where the estate is, where the housing estate is. Above the housing estate is his farm. Not that side of the valley, and how them cows got into that park is beyond me. The only way you could go in was across this bridge with the gate shut. Possibly you could have gone out like a mile further up the road and gone up and come around from the back, but you know, there was nothing up with the cows. They weren't, apparently they were in good health and anything. Nothing had happened as far as we're aware. They were returned to the Royd farm, it was, owned by Roy Starkey's dad. Can't just remember his name now. But the farm's still there. The family's still there, run by his son. Very mysterious. I reported it when I got back to the Nick. And then I went home. And as I was getting undressed for bed, I was just taking my boots off, my police boots, Doc Martens. The sole of the left boot, if that's the sole, there was a split that way, widthways, right across, which was unusual, they're pretty damn new boots. As I took my socks off, there was a red mark about the size of a penny on the instep of my left foot, which was, it wasn't dirty, it was red, but it was very itchy. So I just put some ointment on it, and then I went to bed. Following, well, it's the same day, because you finish at 6 in the morning and you start 10 o'clock that night. So it's the same day, if you like, where I've gone to sleep. I remember going in at for the night shift again, excuse me. And of course, I was Captain Kirk or Mr. Spock, you know, a lot of joviality, shall we say. And I took it in good faith. We laughed about it. And it was somebody put a cartoon, or drawn a cartoon, I cut it out of paper or something and had it on my locker. You know, who shot JR? Remember JR from Dallas or something? I don't know. Anyway, it was about that same time. Several days passed. But what I didn't know was one of the day shift, every day the local paper rings the police station, rings the ambulance station, rings the fire station for anything that may or may not have happened during the night. One of them thought it'd be a good idea if he told them about my sighting or my encounter. And of course, the following week, there it was on front page. So then it had spread then from just the police, if you like, into the public domain, albeit local. Of course, people, in fact, one or two people actually came up and said they'd seen the same object that night. But I just took it with a pinch of salt. I just thought they were taking the mick. Then an inspector from our divisional headquarters came to see me, and he informed me that, in fact, I believed at the time it was the same night, but apparently it must have been the week before. But for nearly 30 years, I thought this, it was the same night. But anyway, roughly about the same time in the morning, three police officers in our division, one being a dog handler, police lady and a policeman, they've been up on the moors above Halifax, which is about 12 miles away from Tomedy. And they were going to retrieving some motorbikes. They'd locked some lads up and they said they did them in this quarry. And they went up there to get the to retrieve them. And whilst they're up there, the dog started barking, the police dog. You know, barking as some hairs on it. And I think it was Julie, the police lady, that became very aware. And she pointed out that with this object on the horizon, blue, pulsating, zigzagging across from one horizon to the other, which, when you're on top of the moors, you're talking 30 miles that way and 30 miles that way, and it was going, and it was blue, pulsating. So all three of them were looking at it, and then eventually it kind of came towards them and swooped and then veered off. I went in the general direction of Tomedon. Months and months and months later, a report came in from the Greater Manchester Police, which is, funny enough, it's only 5 miles away from our border. Two traffic police officers, again, the same night apparently, was parked up on the moors on their side of the valley. And they became aware they were having a fag and doing the pocketbooks ready for going off duty, and they became aware of this object hovering between pylons, you know, electricity pylons go across moors, they're very tall and massive, hovering above them but in between them. And they looked at each other and they watched it for a while, and then it shot off again in the general direction of Tomedon. And as I say, I came across this object in Tomedon. And so in theory, six police officers saw the same object, but we can't be sure, you know. But for 30 years, I was always led to believe that the three in Halifax actually happened on the same night, or the early hours of the morning, but apparently it happened the week before. And basically that happened, the incident happened, I believe it was only 3 weeks or 3.5 weeks before the famous Rendlesham Forest happened, you know, the US Air Force base in Brentwaters, which I was totally unaware of, but it was only 3 or 4 weeks before their major sighting. So it makes you wonder, doesn't it, what's going on?
The public notice came about because your colleague had went ahead and let the media know. How long after?
As a joke.
Yeah.
As a joke.
As a joke, and then it took on a life of its own.
Yeah, not enough.
Did you start to have kind of like recriminations from that? Or was there any kind of unpleasantness, let's say, from at that time or later from the authorities?
Not at that moment, James. What happened was about a year later, apart from usual jovility, you know, it became a bit of a standing joke. And sometimes members of the public, you know, they bumped into and they'd say, you know, have you seen any more aliens and that sort of stuff, you know. It's something I'd have done if it meant another officer, you know. It didn't bother me that much. About a year later, I was contacted by Detective Chief Inspector, Head of the Fraud Squad of the Greater Manchester Force, that had been, that was aware of his officer's sighting, do you get me? So he contacted me at Tomlin Police Station, asking if I'd be prepared to be interviewed by him. And I said, well, I haven't done out wrong, thinking you fraud squad. No, he said, no. He says, I'm very interested in UFOs. He'd had a sighting himself, apparently, at Manchester, near Manchester Airport. But anyway, I agreed to meet him, and he came to my house with Harry Harris, who was a solicitor, Mike Sachs, who'd had an encounter in Baker, which is only 2 or 3 miles from Tomlin. And they were quite genuine. They asked me if I'd do an interview with him via video. So I said, yeah, okay. So they're kind of doing what you're doing now, but a lot not as professional. You know, it was, we're all in the same room. And during the interview, they filmed it and with my consent, and they talked a bit, and then off they went. And then, I don't know, a couple of weeks later, maybe, Norman rang me up, Norman Collinson, who was the chief inspector of the fraud squad, rang me up at home and said, Alan, going off what you've told us, there appears to be some about half an hour missing. We've done the run you did. I said, it's about half an hour missing from your time. Which I couldn't explain. I had no idea. I had no recollection of time, any missing time. So, could we come and see you again? So they did. And they were at that stage where they asked me if I'd be willing to go on hypnotic regression. Well, the only hypnosis I'd ever heard of or ever seen was stage hypnotism, you know, where they have your buddy pretending you're in the Grand National. And really, and I said, no, I'm not doing that. And I was going away on holiday. And while I was away on holiday, I had to think about it. And I came back and I said, under this hypnosis you're on about, what you're hoping to achieve, you know. And they said, well, it'll be done under medical conditions. We've got two psychiatrists lined up, one being Professor Blair, who was the Professor of Psychiatry at Manchester University. The other one was Dr. Joseph Jaffe, who was a very eminent psychiatrist in Manchester, who actually worked on some certain cases with the police. And it would be done under medical conditions. You'd be wired up to measure your heartbeats and brain things and all sorts of other stuff. I said, well, let me think about it, which I did. And I said, okay, I'll give it a go, but I don't know what you're expecting to, because I've no memory of any missing time. And the first hypnotic regression, none of the psychiatrists, by the way, knew what the subject matter was. All they were told, I was a police officer, blah, blah, blah. And something had happened 12 months prior or thereabouts. And they wanted to know more about it. So that's all they knew. And each psychiatrist didn't know about the other psychiatrist. So the two were kept completely separate. The first session took place with Professor Blair. It wasn't filmed. He wouldn't allow it. But he did it privately, just me and him in a room. When it had finished, I couldn't even remember what I'd said. I didn't think. I just thought I'd fallen asleep and I'd woken up. Came downstairs and he just said to him, something very weird happened to that young man. The times you've given me, something very weird and very strange. He said, I'd like to see him again at a later date. So I agreed. In the meanwhile, about 2 weeks later, so thereabouts, I did the other psychiatrist. And he asked me if I was willing to, for it to be filmed, you know, give my permission, which I did. So they videotaped that one. And again, I come out with this incredible story, apparently. Bear in mind, I had no knowledge of what I'd said in hypnosis. I then went back to Blair and did the same thing, which was filmed. And then back to Joseph Jaffe, again, which was filmed. So there was three sessions that were filmed. At this point, I was immediately contacted, well, at work, the superintendent came to see me, and who'd been made aware that these sessions were going on. And no idea how he knew, but he did, and he put a stop to it. So I had to not do any more. At that stage, the arrangements were made for me to go to Harry Harris's house in Salley, it was, in Manchester. And whilst I was there, this was the first time that I was being allowed to see the videotapes. Jenny Randalls was present, Mike was present, and obviously Harry's wife was present. And a couple of other people I can't just spring to mind. No, Norman, the detective chief inspector. I sat there and watched these three videos, which were about, and I just couldn't believe what I'd come out with. It just didn't make. I'm sat there watching myself talking under hypnosis about being abducted. And my brain just wouldn't, it couldn't comprehend what I was. I thought, oh, hang on a minute. But the strange thing, I'm going to have to go back slightly. After each session, as I was driving home, I was sick. And I had nightmares. Or I dreamt, not call them nightmares, but I dreamt after each session, I dreamt about these egg-shaped, lamp-shaped, call them what you like, with black eyes. And it frightened me, but they were just dreams. But it happened after each session. But anyway, get back to the viewings. And to this day, I don't really know whether what I said under hypnosis was actually true. The part where I actually drove from the town centre and all that's in the videos, up to me seeing it, and then the white flash. But after that, no memory. Apparently, it was at that stage where I had this incredible encounter. Now, whether it really happened or not, I don't really know. A part of me likes to believe that it didn't happen. because, you know, it'd be frightening, wouldn't it? Not thinking that something had happened to you and you had no memory of it. It'd be like being drugged, wouldn't it, you know? The other part, shall I say, the inquisitive part, tends to think, well, if it did happen, I'm still here. Obviously, I wasn't harmed in any way. And why me? You know what I mean, James? But there you are, there's two sides of me now. One believes that, was it a figment of my imagination, shall I say? Because a long time had elapsed from the actual event. And I had read a few books. I started taking a bit of an interest in UFOs, in particular Betty and Barney Hill. I read an account that they'd been so was I imagining, because they put this in my head that I had this time missing, although I've no memory of any time missing, prior to the hypnosis. I started wondering what had happened in that time, you know. And I said, I'd like to believe that what I said under hypnosis was probably a mixture of a true event, which I have a memory of, and a figment of my imagination event, where my mind has, you know, you can have a dream sometimes when you're in bed at night, and it takes you to places you've never been before, doesn't it? And nothing makes sense, does it? And you get up the following morning and you've kind of forgotten about it, but you remember that you had this strange... Well, it was a bit like that. And I think it either happened or it didn't, but I have no way of proving either way. So I never claim as a conscious memory. I've never claimed I've been abducted. I've always said that I had this encounter, which did happen. But under hypnosis, I come out with this extra bit that I don't know if it happened or not. It's only what I've said under hypnosis. It's like, does hypnosis tell the truth? I have no idea. Some people seem to think it does. Some people think it doesn't. Well, there you go. That's basically the two incidents we talked about earlier that had affected my life.
Can you talk a bit, Alan, about what came out under regression? Like,
yeah. Well, apparently after the flash, now you've got to remember, I am answering questions that have been asked. I don't narrate anything. I'm asked a question by the psychiatrist who asked me a question, and I reply to his question. The first question he asked me was, I'm just trying to get my head around it now because I have no conscious memory of it, is he? He asked me, apparently, I remember I put my hands up like that when that flash happens. And then he's asking me, what was happening, and I said I'm floating or something, and then the next thing I'm in a room, and in the room this tall guy, I call him a humanoid, in a long white clothing with a skull cap, and then I mention these little, I call them robots, little, about eight of them, about 3 foot high. But, and I say I don't like them, and I'm for some reason, they're frightening me or upsetting me. But this guy, the tall guy, I end up calling him Joseph, which I later changed to Yosef for some reason. But anyway, what happened there? I can't just remember what to say there. It's very difficult when you haven't got a conscious memory. I'm trying to remember what I said on hypnosis. Apparently, they do some sort of examination on me. One on me, they attached something to my left leg and my right wrist. I can't remember what I said, to be honest with you. I haven't seen the tapes for years. But basically, I get, under hypnosis, apparently I get abducted. There's a dog and all involved somewhere. I remember just come to mind. And that's about it. As I've no conscious memory of it, you see. When I was writing the book, I wrote the book off a lot of notes that I did at the time, and video. I had a little Dixon's tape recorder. I don't know what you want to call them. I'm 70, and I recorded a lot of things on it, different tapes. And that's how I managed to. It took me 15 years to write the book. And somewhere along the line, I had the videotape of me under hypnosis, but I don't have it now. And if I have, I've no idea where it is. We moved out since then. But basically, that's what it was. Apparently, I was taken on board this craft and physically examined, and then dumped back in my police car, and off it went. I can't really tell you any more than that.
There were two distinct type of beings, the taller humanoid with the skull cap and then smaller beings?
Yeah.
Besides him?
A dog.
A dog? In the craft?
Apparently so, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Very strange. That's what... But... yeah, there was a tall guy who I called Joseph, and then there were eight of these little creatures, but I call them robots. Is the hour up?
Yeah, we're just about at the end of the first hour. We'll have all of Alan's book information, because it's a story that I think that really needs wide dissemination, because we're just getting started here. So we'll see you at the top of the next hour. You've been watching and listening to our special guest, Alan Godfrey. This is the Cosmic Switchboard Show, James Bartley, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.